Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul on Wednesday this week announced her support for medical aid in dying legislation. The Legislative Gazette's Sagina Shrestha has details on Hochul's decision and more.
The Democrat wrote in an opinion article in the Albany Times-Union that she intends to sign legislation to allow for physician-assisted death for terminally ill patients. But first, Hochul is requiring the New York State Legislature to agree to additional guardrails on the measure that passed both houses in June. The additional amendments, first reported in the Gothamist, were added earlier this month. They include a mandatory 5-day waiting period to provide the patient the chance to change their mind, as well as requirements that requests be written and recorded. The bill was considered for the 10th consecutive year this June. A few days before her public announcement, the governor was asked about her stance. At the time, Hochul said she was deliberating her choices and took a more neutral approach.
This is a very challenging moral question for individuals, and that is why I've taken the time and am treating this very seriously, because I know there's very heartfelt, strong emotions on both sides of the debate.
In the Times Union article, the governor, who is Roman Catholic, wrote that she has reflected deeply on the controversial issue, saying that while many faiths believe deliberately shortening one's life violates the sanctity of life, she has come to see the matter as one of personal choice. Curran Carey, the senior campaign director of Compassion and Choices, has been at the forefront of advocating for the bill. She says the legislation helps terminally ill New Yorkers gain agency over their own lives. She added that supporters will be watching the bill and its amendments closely, making sure it serves those in need.
We will obviously be carefully monitoring whether these additional safeguards constitute barriers to care, and we will go back to the legislature and say, you know, we've got to lift some of these additional restrictions, not to expand the bill as opponents have said that we would always do, but to ensure that the bill that the legislature passed that was designed to give access to the broadest number of people.
Opponents of the bill, which includes religious organizations and disability advocates, say the definition of a terminal condition in the bill is too vague. Jessica Rogers is the coalition director of the Patients' Rights Action Fund, a non-religious advocacy group. In an interview with the Legislative Gazette in October, Rogers explained that the bill lacks any requirements for treatments and as a result could lead to more harm than good.
The key here is that treatment is never required. So if you have a condition that could become terminal or is terminal if you don't have treatment or you can't access treatment and can't afford treatment or if you refuse treatment, then under the law, you are considered to have a terminal condition.
The New York State Catholic Conference responded to Hochul's decision, writing that the bill will undermine all of the anti-suicide and mental health care investments the governor has made while leading New York. If New York passes the Medical Aid in Dying Act, it would join roughly a dozen states, including Vermont and New Jersey, that allow for some form of assisted death at the end of life.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Sagina Shrestha.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With me is Curran Carey, the campaign director for Compassion and Choices. She and a large team of folks working almost a decade on trying to pass a Medical Aid in Dying Act in New York, and we learned that Governor Kathy Hochul is supporting the legislation. She
posted a commentary in the Albany Times Union. I got you out of bed, Corinne. We've talked over the years over the years about this, and I know you've had time to look at the governor's commentary. A lot of hard work put into this. Now some real success from your perspective, I know. How are you feeling?
I am feeling very deeply emotional, David. I read the governor's words this morning, and she's making this decision for all the reasons that I thought she would. Her commitment to freedom and bodily autonomy, her belief in compassion, her belief in the evidence, and her own personal, you know, experiences with witnessing someone who's suffering. It's very gratifying. I have to say, you said almost 10 years. It's been 10 years and about 7 months. So 10 and a half years of this. And I've watched people suffer over and over and over again. We've lost 29 advocates. And I do believe we're going to lose more people who've traveled to Albany and begged lawmakers for this option before it's all said and done, because this bill will not go into effect until probably July, probably the summer of 2026.
And, you know, there was some last-minute negotiations. She wanted some changes, some more provisions in there to protect New Yorkers. You know, many of the major opponents were worried about protections there. Can you give us any insight into what that was?
Sure. The governor really, true to her word, reviewed the bill carefully with her staff. And so we've been speaking with members of her staff since the bill passed in June by both houses. Well, it was passed by the Assembly in April and then by the Senate in June. And ever since then, we've been talking to her staff about different provisions of the bill. You know, there were a number of amendments that we thought were really good additions to the bill. There were a few that we had to push back on for the sake of the people that we advocate for. And then there were a few that were easy to compromise on. It was important to her that this bill be limited to New York residents. I don't understand how that is a safeguard. And I do believe that people receiving care in New York state institutions should have the same end of life rights as those who live in New York. But, you know, I understand every other state has had a residency requirement. Some states have rolled them back because we brought lawsuits. Compassion and Choices sued those states to say that the residency requirement was unconstitutional. But most states have them, and a court decision just upheld the residency restriction in New Jersey. So I understand that. She also, the governor also wanted to really make sure that someone is not suffering from any mental health condition that would cloud their judgment. And so she required that a psychiatrist or a psychologist be an individual that has to see that person when they make the request. That started out as a psychiatrist. We argued that there were not enough psychiatrists in New York, and she understood that. So I believe that more mental health professionals are capable of doing this determination, but I think we landed in an okay place on that. And there's an audio requirement that someone who is requesting medical aid in dying make an audio recording. And we were concerned about that, but after speaking with healthcare providers and learning how many other files are appended to someone's medical record, we realized that that was something that that most people could live with. And I hope it does not pose a barrier to people who need this care. You know, I think that this bill ended in a good place. We will obviously be carefully monitoring whether these additional safeguards constitute barriers to care, and we will go back to the legislature and say, you know, we've got to lift some of these additional restrictions, not to expand the bill as opponents have said that we would always do, but to ensure that the bill that the legislature passed that was designed to give access to the broadest number of people who are qualified under the law to receive this care are able to do so.
She is Corinne Carey, the campaign director for Compassion and Choices, reacting to the news that Governor Kathy Hochul is going to sign the Medical Aid in Dying Act. Corinne, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me, David.
That's Corinne Carey, campaign director for Compassion and Choices. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York State Energy Planning Board adopted the State Energy Plan this week, which sets a framework to meet energy needs through 2040. Board Chair and NYSERDA President and CEO Doreen Harris tells the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley the plan is a key element for setting state energy policy.
The energy plan is a comprehensive work product to plan for the broadest of needs of our state through 2040. And it really sets the stage for not only policy action, but also policy setting moving into the future as we advance the evolution of our energy system, certainly toward one that is cleaner, more affordable, and more reliable all at the same time.
During the board meeting this week, you called it an ambitious plan in an evolving environment. Energy markets, use, and technology of all of our energy systems are very fast changing. So how does the plan project out over a decade and a half, and how accurately can those projections be?
Of course, there's uncertainty that exists out 10 plus years as one is planning for an energy future. But obviously this year has been even more challenging due to, in specific, the real change in federal policy that has occurred since the Trump administration took office. So in many ways, our plan's evolution from the draft, which was issued in July, and the final plan just this week, reflects the real headwinds that we're seeing from the federal administration, both with respect to cost increases, but also a true assault on clean energy deployment that needed to be taken into account in the final plan. So planning always involves many scenarios for the future because of those uncertainties. In this instance, the plan reflects, as I had said, a level of ambition that is quite notable. Certainly, Governor Hochul has made clear her prioritization of clean energy in the first instance, but also a plan that is achievable, that we know is reflective of the reality of the time in which we're living and the need to balance not just clean energy, but affordable, reliable, and resilient energy that can support the very growth that our state is seeing from an economic development perspective at the same time.
Doreen Harris, you mentioned the Trump administration, which seems to be moving away from renewables and really supporting the fossil fuel industry. This latest New York State energy plan really turns towards renewables. Will there be problems implementing New York's plan if the federal government is not supporting some aspects of what's in our state plan?
Well, it remains true that New York is a leader in building out clean, affordable energy for our state, even as we see this federal assault foundationally in many of the technologies that we're talking about. The plan needs to be clear-eyed about those challenges, and I believe that it is. It sets forth a path that remains true, that we're prioritizing clean energy in the first instance. In fact, over this planning horizon, we show an increase of nearly 90% in the build-out, even between now and 2020, 2035 in renewable energy. It also, though, notes importantly the value of diverse resources to address not only the growth of our energy system, but also the value of diversity from a risk mitigation perspective as well. So that is where we look at other technologies, of course, the deployment of renewables in the first instance, but other clean energy technologies like advanced nuclear technologies, as well as solar, onshore wind, and hydroelectric power. And then it does note that in order to preserve this reliable, affordable grid of the future, that we will need to continue to rely on the fossil fuel systems that we have in place today. And in some instances, those systems will need to be repowered. So all that to say is it's a multivariable exercise and one in which the clear motivation was clean energy. It remains clean energy, balanced by other resources as well.
Doreen Harris, the plan also calls for modernizing the state's energy infrastructure, basically the power grid. Not just New York State, but all over the country, the energy grid is aging. This is a 15-year plan. Wouldn't it take longer than 15 years just for New York to upgrade its grid?
Well, it is absolutely true that our infrastructure is aging and it requires investments to continue to function and remain safe and reliable. We have one of the oldest grids in the country. And in fact, we looked to highlight the fact that even with no investments in new energy systems like renewable energy, we would still be spending $150 billion on the maintenance and perhaps renovation of that system. Because for just what you were saying, we have literally a set of generators over half of our installed capacity turning at least 45 years old this year, with many substantially older. So anyone would look at this and say we need to invest in the systems that we have. We are going to be over the coming decades, to your point, not just within 15 years, but even decades beyond, we will be reaching a point in which much of our fossil fuel fired generation capacity will reach an age where it would have normally been retired. So we need to invest in that infrastructure to preserve not only the reliability of our grid, but its broader functioning.
I'm curious how you react to some of the advocacy groups that are saying this plan is too conservative.
This was an area of significant stakeholder comment over the course of the year. I attended all of our hearings across the state. We received 15,000 public comments, and there was a balance. On the one hand, there was a strong imperative to prioritize the affordability of our grid and certainly of our energy systems. And on the other hand, there were many who viewed our level of ambition as not ambitious enough or perhaps too ambitious. So all of this to say that we look at the situation we find ourselves in from a very objective lens, and we build this scenario up. Our plan is built from sets of policies that are in place, the market development that we see, the level of deployment that can be reasonably achieved in these timeframes. And it concludes that, yes, we will continue a very ambitious set of clean energy deployments across every form of clean energy, whether it be offshore wind or nuclear or solar projects. And it also notes, though, that in order to preserve these imperatives that I had laid out, they need to be balanced with other resources at the same time. It's very pragmatic. That's what it is. And I think as time goes on, we are obviously hopeful that we'll see a future in which the federal administration allows us to exceed our expectations from our ambition. And obviously, we'd be well prepared to do so based on the progress we've made already. We've got a number of major infrastructure projects under construction across our state, two offshore wind projects, a very large transmission line moving hydroelectric power from Canada into New York, and many, many solar, wind, and other projects all under development and construction. So the point being, this plan really builds on that momentum, but reflects the growth according to the way the market and the policy context exists today.
That's Doreen Harris, President and CEO of NYSERDA,
discussing the new state energy plan adopted this week in New York. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. School cell phone bans have been gaining popularity across the country in the last few years over concerns about the negative impact devices have on teenagers' mental health, school learning environment, and test scores. It will take time to see if cell phone bans actually address those issues, but New York adopted its own cell phone ban starting this fall, after a strong push from Governor Kathy Hochul and the New York State United Teachers. The ban is bell-to-bell, meaning no cell phones from the beginning of the school day to the end, and not just in classrooms. The New York Public News Network's Amy Feiereisel visited the Glens Falls City School District High School to talk to educators and students about how the ban is going.
Carrie Benway has been teaching for almost 30 years, and she had serious doubts about the cell phone ban coming into this fall.
We really were all kind of concerned at the beginning of the school year that was going to be a huge struggle.
After all, Benway says teachers have been playing phone police for years with little effect.
No matter how many times we would tell them to put it away, it would be out, 30 seconds later.
But a semester into the cell phone ban, Benway is a convert. She says it's been a night and day change.
It's been great. I mean, the kids have been compliant, and it's one less battle we have to fight every single day.
Glens Falls isn't an outlier here. In a recent state survey of over 300 New York school districts, about 90% reported the cell phone ban transition was going smoothly, and 80% reported an improvement in the classroom environment and student engagement. Glens Falls High School principal Kevin Warren says the cafeteria is one of the places he notices the absence of cell phones the most.
One of the biggest things is our students are talking to each other. Obviously, they're eating. It is lunchtime, but there's a lot of communication that is happening at tables now.
Groups of kids are sitting at round tables, eating and chatting. A few of them do have laptops out. Those are allowed. This is a one-to-one school, meaning each kid has their own school-issued MacBook, which have social media sites like TikTok and Instagram blocked.
The one thing that they are able to do is through their Google Gmail accounts, they are able to communicate with parents.
Students and parents can also use the school office phones to get in touch. As to the actual cell phones, Glens Falls' policy is simple. Before the school day starts, phones have to be turned off and in lockers. If a student is seen using their phone, administrators like Principal Warren are the enforcers, not teachers.
They just contact administration. We go up, we ask the student to come out, just so there's no conflict with a teacher at that time. We might have maybe 3 to 6 phones a day, if that, sometimes. Some students actually bring their phone to us in the office at the beginning of the day just so they don't have the temptation.
Warren says one of the benefits he's noticed is that administrators are spending a lot less time trying to resolve fights or bullying happening over social media. That was one of the big goals of the ban, as touted by Governor Kathy Hochul and the New York State Teachers Union. They say going phone-free is about fewer distractions in the school day and kids' mental health. I asked Warren about one of the main criticisms of the ban, which is that schools shouldn't be banning phones, but teaching kids how to use devices and emerging technology.
I think there's time and place, and I don't think school is the time or the place. if our students are here to learn, they can learn those other things outside of school.
While all the educators I spoke with were supportive of the ban, unsurprisingly, students' reactions were a lot more mixed. I spoke with a couple dozen Glens Falls high schoolers, and most readily admit that there are some benefits.
Personally, the ban has helped me be more focused and engaged in classrooms.
Not having my phone with me or not having it in my pocket is definitely helping to lessen the temptation to go on my phone.
Last year, if I was bored, I would just pull up TikTok and scroll or something, and I feel like we all did that.
That's 10th graders Lilia Schmidt, Matea Rice, and Sophia Tavares. But they have a lot of skepticism about the ban, too. Matea Rice says kids who were already glued to their phones during lunch are now just glued to their school-issued MacBooks.
It's not getting you that social benefit that it's supposed to. If you are one of the people that would be on your phone instead of talking, you're just going to be on your computer instead of talking.
Students also say that devices often had a legitimate use in classes, like taking pictures of a microscope slide in biology or watching history recaps on YouTube. In their perfect world, phones would be banned during classes, but not during lunch or free periods. But that's essentially what the policy was here before, and it didn't really work, says Rice.
And this might be one of the better ways to do it, because I personally can't think of a better middle.
But students keenly feel as though they've lost something. AirPods have been banned too, so they can't really listen to music anymore. Several students say they miss the social parts of phones, taking selfies and pictures of fun school activities, playing games with their friends. Lilia Schmidt says it's been hard not to be able to check in with her mom throughout the day, especially about mental health stuff.
Now, sometimes it feels like I'm almost isolated because I don't like emailing because then the school can see it. And she's the only person I'd really want to text about that kind of stuff, but I can't anymore.
And lots of kids assured me kids are finding ways around the ban, getting savvier and sneakier. So is this school, or any school, totally phone or distraction-free? Probably not. But it's a dramatic improvement, says Elizabeth Collins, the high school assistant principal. She says out of 600 kids, they've had just a handful of students get to the point of a parent meeting. That comes after four times of being caught with a phone during school hours.
Less than, I'd say, 8 kids that we've had to do that with all year.
When students ask her why phones are being banned and why now, Collins says she's found a pretty good metaphor in cars.
When cars were invented, they didn't have seat belts. But through time and accidents, all these precautions and safety measures have been put into cars. So this is a precaution and safety measure that we've learned is better for your health.
When that doesn't work, Collins says it's pretty helpful to remind students this is a New York state law, and everyone is having to do this together. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Fireisel.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at wamcpodcasts.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2551. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York state government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Happy holidays.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.